He makes computers seem easy, but that pocket protector says otherwise. And now, with a quest of enriching your experience with computers, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up in this hour, Keith and I are going to discuss iOS 27, the public beta, and some of the alternatives I have towards buying a new phone this year. On the scam series, home insurance storm eligibility scam. And then coming up next, I'm going to we had a bad title last week. We recorded something and we mixed up the files. So it's going to be Rita on organizing files across cloud services and Tom on helping his family learn basic tech. Funny thing, you know, people reach out to me. You can do it as well at computertalkradio.com. And I had a couple of notes from folks saying, hey, that wasn't what you had said. And it happens. Again, the website, though, communicate with me on all kinds of different things. Computertalkradio.com. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. You can also phone me at 888-NERD 888. That's 888-637-3888. Leave a message and I will get back with you. Let's dive into the news from the past week. And back in 2019, the Apple Card was announced and released. Samsung usually counters items from Apple with rapid responses, but instead waited until now to release their own, yes, card. Samsung basically worked with Barclays Bank, and they are the Visa card issuer here. Apple Card is the MasterCard. And after a quick dive, it actually seems there's not much to differentiate between the Apple or the Samsung card, except using your own device ecosystem that you're already part of. Matching up, it's another virtual and physical metal card with rewards for ecosystem purchases, cash back, and so forth and so on. Apple's spending trackers and family management aren't there yet in the Samsung card, but I'm going to just read into the future, and I'm going to say that's probably going to come soon enough. Now, back in January, Flock's CEO, Garrett Langley, referred to DFlock, a group that's building a map to track Flock's license plate reader cameras, as a, quote, terroristic organization. This past week, in summary, that was back in January, he said that. This past week, he backtracked and he said he was sorry, but he tried to shift the blame back then to those looking for transparency, which is alarming. Yes, I know that we've seen a spike in what I will admit are questionable or even illegal acts against these cameras, but not because of DFlock. Instead, those acts appear to be part of what is really a growing frustration by people who don't like being spied upon. Yet, we all need to reflect as to why these some 120,000 cameras are in neighborhoods, peering down our streets, watching our every move, and being cataloged with significant amounts of detail. There's more that we don't know, that we can surmise about Big Brother, and it's actually up to us to all be questioning, as we should. Anytime somebody starts to move in on our privacy. Now, just when I thought we wouldn't hear any more about the RAM issue and AI causing ripples, it got worse. It seems that the demand for RAM has driven automakers to predict a surge in pricing due to the amount of computer chips in their cars. GM, Ford, Hyundai, and BYD have all indicated their struggles on the road and announced price increases directly tied to this. We're going to probably see more coming along from the other manufacturers. In 2023, Micron advised that the average vehicle used about 90 gigs of RAM and NAND storage. So that's the RAM, and we can call it the hard drive space. Recently, they also said that the average car has about 16 gigs of DRAM, and level 4 autonomous driving could use as much as 300 gigs. That's a lot of DRAM. That's a lot of storage. That's a lot of usable memory. And another set of ripple effects that are likely going to get worse in the coming years as usage climbs. We need more memory for the self-driving stuff. And oh yes, as RAM prices climb faster. Now, I wish I made this up. And this next story, and it just boggles my mind. Let's start with the idea of BattleBots. This is a TV show that I occasionally watched years back. Two robots of sorts would go into a ring and they would fight each other. And it was more of a remote control thing back then. But off in China, there's a new thing. The Ultimate Robot Knockout Legend Tournament. And they had a new bout and a number of robots squared off against each other. The winning game, though, basically, the teams programmed their robots, set them out against each other, and one took the final round by kicking the competitor's head off. Now, the part that's all normal so far. The part that really concerns me is the platform is referred to as the Engine T-800. Now, if that doesn't ring a bell for you, maybe you haven't seen the Terminator movies, where you would recognize that Arnold Schwarzenegger's robot, the Terminator, was the T-800. Wow. It just makes me think that perhaps the future that Sarah Connor was concerned about, afraid of, is already here. That's just chilling to me. Now, our technology can be disrupted by solar storms, so there's a lot of folks out there that pay attention to what our sun does, studying to prepare for another Carrington event. Now, that's a solar storm that zapped us back in 1859. And there was good news and bad news in the last week about this. The good news is that they're getting better at predicting and have found cool ways, statistical analysis, to predict the roughly 11-year-long cycle and how bad the solar peak is going to be. The bad news is that since we've really only been studying this for under 200 years, we don't really know what the once-in-a-thousand years storm could be. The latest info, again this last week, indicates that previous theories on an upper limit could be wrong, hideously, scarily wrong, and mostly understate the potential for solar impact. Now, this isn't a time to panic. This isn't a time to worry or anything like that. But it does mean that we may need to, in our technology-driven world, also reevaluate what we do to protect technology and us, the users of technology, in the future. Closing out, one of the approaches that tech CEOs are looking at is personal bodyguards. Why? Well, it seems that recent events have shown that there's a backlash against data centers, AI, cameras, as well as various personal concerns like job loss and more. And these are all raising concern. There have been a few recent incidents, and it seems that tech companies are now incorporating protection into their budgets to ensure that these CEOs are safe from harm. None of these are valid concerns for people at large to deliver threats, but it does give us a pulse on public opinion, which appears to be straining recently against all of the different tech companies that are delivering really what is concerning news for a lot of people. Coming up next, Rita on organizing files across cloud services and Tom on helping his family learn basic tech. Just a couple of questions here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
Let me give out the phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. I'm going to ask you to leave a message for me, leave a voicemail. I will get back to you. If you give me your email there, your phone number, whichever you want, I will get back to you with your contact location of choice. With answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Now, Rita asked how she can organize years of scattered files across different cloud services. And I'm going to start off with saying that the best first place to go is to really choose practicality. Choose one service that acts as your home base. You can keep all of them if you want, but there should be one. The one that has probably the most space as well as the one that's most reliable. And when you start putting everything in the same place, then that whole system becomes easier to manage. And you want to really set up an organization here. You want to gather the files that you use most often. And you move the essentials first. And this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. You're not going to just say, okay, I'm going to spend 1 hour and everything is going to be done. Because it's really going to be just you dragging and dropping everything into that one service. And then it's not organized. It's in one space instead of all over the place. But that's not how you want to organize. Gather the files that you use most often. Then move the essentials into their own dedicated folders, wherever that goes. Doing that first gives you a sense of progress without forcing you to tackle the entire archive at once, which will overwhelm you. Now, many cloud services offer built-in tools that will help you spot the duplicates and the large files. Using these tools along the way, early on, get used to them. That can reduce a lot of the clutter as you go through and you start sorting things out. I suggest creating a simple folder structure that is short names, personal, business, job search, you know, things like that. And then you scatter them throughout additional subfolders, which do the same thing. You might have a dedicated folder for photos, and then you start organizing them, whether you want to organize them by when you took them or who they're of primarily. Who are the most photos of my family, photos of work, photos of vacations, however you want to do that, and you spread them out. But you start going through setting up these categories. And these categories are a lot easier to maintain than a long list of detailed or even just random labels. And I suggest set aside just a small block of time just every week or so for some level of cleaning this all up, bringing this all together. Regular attention to this prevents any kind of backlog from growing again. We all have become digital hoarders. We all have files all over the place. What you want to do is you want to just take little bite-sized chunks out of cleaning up these files. And as you move along, these scattered pieces will start to form a coherent library. You know where things live, and you stop hunting through, okay, let's check in Microsoft. No, it's not there. Let's check in Dropbox. Let's check in Google Cloud and all of that. And this is probably your biggest thing. But from what you've been saying, that's where we need to be going. Once the system settles down, your files are going to feel like a resource instead of a burden. The cloud becomes a place you trust rather than a place you avoid. Tom asked how he can help a family member who refuses to learn basic tech skills. Now, this is something that I have used for ages. You focus on one task that family member genuinely cares about. You teach them just one thing. People learn faster when the skill that you're teaching connects directly to something they want to do. Of course, along the way, you want to keep the instructions short and concrete, and that'll help make the process less intimidating. Long explanations are going to create confusion. You want to go through and just help with the clarity. This is how you do this one thing. Now, a lot of people go the route of demonstrating the steps. I actually walk them through the steps. I have them take that hands-on approach. Okay, I'm going to show you how to do this. You're going to drag this here and then just drop it. There you go. That's how you do it. This is all easy. See how easy this is? Great. When you watch that process unfold, it is so much easier than following like a written guide or trying to duplicate what someone just did or watching the videos and all of this. This helps that family member try the steps themselves while you're there. You're there as their support system, and you're building up this muscle memory confidence in a way that them sitting and watching you do it is never going to work. And I don't want you to introduce extra features. I want you to avoid showing shortcuts. I want you to do the basic, simple item without too many options. Those options, those features and shortcuts and all of that, they're going to overwhelm the person who's still learning basics. You may understand a lot of these things. You want to walk them through that and say, at the end of this, I'll answer your questions, whatever you have. Over time, that small little success is going to build a trust. They're going to begin to see that technology isn't out to confuse them or trick them or anything like that. As their comfort grows over multiple sessions and conversations, you can start throwing in more complex tasks. Each new skill becomes easier because it builds on something that's familiar, something they've already done. That slow and steady approach is going to reduce that frustration that they're really facing there. The learning becomes a shared experience rather than a point of tension. And when they finally handle a task on their own, they're going to feel accomplishment. And that sense of accomplishment is real. It shows them that they're more capable than they assumed before diving in. And you just use this one at a time, and you create a foundation, hopefully off of related items, not just the same one. When we look at these, both Rita's question and Tom's question, these both point to a same quiet principle. Progress comes from choosing one clear starting point and then building from there. It doesn't matter if you're sorting years of cloud files or guiding someone through their first tech steps. The work becomes manageable when you focus on what matters most right now, in that moment. That focus will keep the process steady. And when you take that approach, the whole landscape, everything, becomes less overwhelming. You move through it with purpose instead of pressure. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and MicroCenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit MicroCenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. The phone number 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. Give me a holler. I will, of course, get your voicemail. Leave a message, and I will get back to you with answers to your questions and your technology, your computer questions, your technology concerns. You know, every once in a while, I botch that. That's okay. That's the laughter of Keith M. Sidor, who joins me now. And Keith, what do you have for us this week?
Well, having known my good friend Benjamin for well over a decade, I know your, shall we call them, technological predilections. And unlike me, who is very, very conservative when it comes to my operating systems, I would like to know, on your iPhone 14, you man living dangerously, what is the public beta of iOS 27 like?
It just barely came out.
I know you've got to be running it.
It just barely came out. And you think I went to it?
If I were one of those, what do they call them, lifestyle betting, where they bet on what people are just going to do and stuff, I would bet the family farm that you are already on the public beta of iOS 27.
And you want to know the truth?
Yes.
You just lost the family, its entire fortune.
Come on, I can't believe you.
No, yeah. Okay, all right. In all fairness, in past years, I have taken the leap. Generally not on the very first one, but sometimes on the very first public beta.
The leap from toast to toasted sandwiches. This is good.
I'm going to tell you, though. Uh-huh. I have made a very, for me, it's a heavy decision. I chose not to go to the beta version of 27 this year.
Really?
I have been a fan of knowing what's coming so that I can represent it to the audience, to everybody listening, and to my friends and say, hey, this is exciting, or this is boring, or this is somewhere in between. I'm going to tell you this time around, I have no real deep desire to go to it. I already know that there's going to be very few things that are going to be coming along with the iOS 27 that's going to really work on my 14 Pro.
Okay, that having been said, you are, if not an early adopter, I know you're not going to not go to iOS 27 sooner rather than later. So my real question is, does this mean that you will just install the final release candidate when it comes out on this phone? Mm-hmm. Or now that it's been 4 years with the iPhone 14, will you simply upgrade to the 18 or the 18 Pro models?
So this is the decision I'm trying to make right now. Okay. This is there's a few things that are floating around in my mind. One of them is wait until it's finalized and we know that it's going to be not a big, huge battery drain on my four-year-old phone. That is probably one of my biggest concerns. I know in past years, the initial release items like the one that came out this last week, they've been battery drains. Well, I am at the point right now where my battery's kind of teetering on the edge. So One of the things that I've been pondering through is, what is my next move? Now, I am thinking maybe it is time. I have the budget for it. I've actually saved quite a bit of money because I typically have replaced at the 2-year mark. Mm-hmm. And I bank the money aside so that I can get it. So I'm actually ahead by 2 phone versions. So I could easily go on out and get it. It's all in the budget. It's all right there. And I can spend money elsewhere too. But that's another story. But there's a lot that's going through my head. I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about, for the 10-year anniversary, they released a lot for the hardware. So that's true.
The iPhone 10, which is a Roman numeral 10, looked like iPhone X. That was a good phone, and I had that phone myself. And it's funny, Benjamin. There has been, and I know we don't typically traffic in the rumor mill, but there's been so much talk about not just the iPhone 18 and 18 Pro models, which are expected out this fall, but Apple finally joining the fray that Samsung and the other carriers have done a few years ago with a foldable phone, which would cost as much as a fairly well-equipped laptop computer. I've been thinking so much about that. It was you who made me think about the 20th anniversary iPhone in 2027. So, I've got some thinking to do as well.
So I will answer the question you didn't ask, which is, I will not go to a foldable.
Is it the form factor or the price? Because these things were originally rumored to be in the $1,500 to $1,900 range. Now, with all the shortages and the prices of components going up, they're talking about this thing being well over $2,500 for the base model. And I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah. So just as you are out for price, and I would have also kind of, that would have been a factor in my decision, the form factor itself doesn't excite me. The constant problems that Samsung has had, even up until I think it was a year ago, we were talking about the latest one that came out, and within days we had constant reports about screen issues. Lesser so than before, but you know what? I want a durable phone. One of the things I've done in the past has been to take my phone with a suitable case on it. These days, OtterBox is probably the go-to if you want that durable case. But I would throw my phone over my shoulder just to show off to people how durable the phone was, as well as the case. And I feel like the foldable isn't going to do that. I am going to tell you, though, one of the things that I've been seeing a lot of lately that I may be considering, especially since my battery and my wife's battery, both of them are already kind of challenged. We're both down at that roughly 80% light.
That's where I am on my iPhone 15 Pro Max.
So I've been thinking of actually taking the leap and taking it into the local Apple store and paying the $100 for the battery upgrade, which...
Here's what happened to me one time, Benjamin, with the iPhone 6 Plus. When I went in there for the battery replacement, because I had comparable issues, it was like $100 to replace the battery, Or for $150, they would upgrade me to a refurbished iPhone 6S Plus, which was the whole next year's model chip, S-series chip. And I did that. So for like 1 year before I went to the 10, I did the 6S Plus because it was only $50 more than just swapping out the battery on my 6 Plus.
If I walked in and they offered me a nice upgrade deal, I might consider it. I'd have to weigh it out. But, you know, that is something for me to pay attention to and to think about. It's something that I think a lot of people are going to need to start thinking about this.
Because they want you on those new AI features on a more powerful phone.
There is that, definitely. But as for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Seedorf.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
The website ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That is one way to reach out to us. Of course, you can scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. You can also check out the podcast there, as well as all of our news items that we cover each week. We do post to them up there, giving you a chance for a deeper dive. Again, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, one of the things that you and I have tracked over the years is Faraday cages, as far as actually it's more Faraday bags. And
Faraday, people, Faraday is not an actor on a soap. Michael Faraday was a scientist who did a lot with electromagnetic fields. We're talking about shielding. We're talking about keeping bad signals and bad spikes out of your gear. So a Faraday bag, by definition, is a shielded bag. You can make your own if you can weave in copper mesh, but that's not always a favorite thing to do. And, you know, if it goes bad, that's a lot of copper. You don't get as many pennies as you used to. Where's the copper going to come from?
Yes. Right?
I'm just going to give you a little catalog of why you might not want your phone or your notebook or whatever to deal with this stuff. And before I do, I'm going to mention four letters, S-L-N-T.
Okay.
Those are the non-vowels in silent, S-L-N-T. S-L-N-T is the company whose products I'm going to be talking about here in just a second. Here are the signals: cellular, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS, EMF, electromagnetic force, which is induced power.
Mm-hmm.
Key fobs, RFID or NFC.
Mm-hmm.
Satellite navigational. EMP, HEMP. Those are the pulses that can kill gear.
Yes.
Signal, which can be anything. And solar flares, which have high bursts of
electromagnetic radiation.
So, with all that stuff in the air, it's like being in a polluted atmosphere. It's like being in L.A. when the inversion layer is down.
Yes. Yes.
So, let's say that you're going to an airport. They're going to make you turn it off anyway. When you turn it off, if you stick it in one of these bags, what have you saved yourself? Well, in terms of key fobs, in terms of your credit cards with chips in them, The skimmers can't get at you.
It's interesting. So now you went with the airport approach. One of my things that I've long thought about, long before I was on the radio, over 18 years now, was going off to DEF CON, which is in Las Vegas. It is a big, huge hacking convention. And they've got a lot more than just, you know, electronic hacking. They've got like locksmithing floors and stuff like that. You can find out all about different, I would say, fringe technologies, which if you understand them a little bit more, it's very educational. But one of the things I've been warned about for a long time is if you go there, don't take your cell phone. As a matter of fact, protect everything you've got. So one of these kinds of Faraday bags has long been, if I ever get a chance to go there, I'm going to jump on out. I'm going to make sure that I've got a Faraday bag for all of my tech.
Absolutely. Now, the one I'm holding up, you can't see it because your radio doesn't have a picture tube, but what I'm holding up right now is not huge. The biggest phones, some of the almost tablet-sized phones will fit in here.
Yeah.
I've got a bigger one that'll hold one of the smaller laptops, maybe a bigger one. I haven't tried to overstuff it. This one has two pockets. It's got a Faraday pocket,
yes,
which is sizable, and boy, the clamp on there really tells me it's going to be sealed when it's sealed, and not electronically sealed. And it's got a convenience pocket. So if you want to... Yeah, you want to put your plane ticket in there and it's paper, safe already. If the ticket's on the phone, you might have to pull it out for a minute, but then stick it right back in. Now, a lot of strange questions come up. Can I use it and put my phone in the bag and make a call using my Bluetooth headphones?
Off of that list, you've already mentioned Bluetooth won't work, and it won't matter because the phone is in the bag, so the cellular signal isn't going to work either.
You may also want to put your earbuds in the bag because a hacker can figure out what your pairing is.
Yes, yes.
And guys, there are a lot of bad people out there.
Yes, one or two.
and with SLNT, you know, protection is in the bag.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, bad puns. Bad jokes can be forgiven.
So, what kind of price point are we looking at for these for Faraday bags these days? What does that one run?
I don't know. I've had it here for a while, and prices change. So
okay,
I'd hate to quote it. So SLNT. If you go there, I'm sure they'll tell you all about it. I believe I remember it being slnt.com. But there may be a reference at hand if I can get back into the bag. Hello, bag. What do we have?
It looks like, so that's a Faraday phone sleeve. It looks like it runs about 80 to 100 bucks. But that kind of price is priceless. It's definitely worth a peace of mind in keeping your tech safe from the bad guys.
Yeah, absolutely that. And among the guys I've seen, this is the tightest construction I've seen.
All right. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade, but I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome.
siteground.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com.
The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. One of the things that I encountered just a short while back was a severe weather event rolled through my area. And all of a sudden, I started receiving all kinds of messages claiming that I qualify for fast-track home insurance payouts. And I didn't have any issues. I didn't have any problems. But I saw what could happen, and I found out this is a very regular thing. These kinds of messages arrive when people are already stressed. They're worried about damage. And that emotional timing is part of a trap. That trap, everything looks official. It uses insurance-style language and references to the recent storm or earthquake or whatever it is, and it feels like something a real insurer might send during busy claims season. It's the Home Insurance Storm Damage Eligibility Scam, and this is designed to make you click through before you even stop and question things. The scammers want you to believe you're entitled to immediate assistance. The belief that they put there pushes you towards a link that they provide. The message claims your property was flagged for potential damage. You must verify ownership to receive benefits. It frames the request as a simple confirmation, and that framing makes it feel routine. The link leads to a portal, and that portal is going to ask you for what? Oh, yeah. Name, address, policy number, photos of your home. All of this sounds like a legitimate claim, but it actually builds a detailed profile of your property. Along the way, they may ask for social security numbers or banking information to process this payout. No, this is just a standard requirement. This allows us to put the money into your bank. We've got to report it to the IRS. All of this, it's totally normal. In reality, they're harvesting your identity and financial details. Once they have this information, what can they do? Well, file fraudulent claims, redirect payouts, or open accounts in your name. They may also target your real insurer using the details you provided. And all of this unfolds behind the scenes, quietly and quickly, sometimes without you even knowing. This scam works because all of these different things, these different incidents, create confusion, and people expect insurers to reach out proactively. Attackers hide inside that expectation. They mimic the parts of the process you expect to see. Real insurers, they don't initiate claims through unsolicited messages. They don't ask for sensitive information through weird, strange, unverified portals. They communicate through your agent, through established channels. They require very formal documentation. Those boundaries are part of the whole entire process. If you ever receive a message like this, I want you to contact your agent directly or use the insurance number on your policy. That simple step actually bypasses all of these scammers and keeps you in control of the entire claims process. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Laptops, thumb drives, and a wall charger. A sure sign that our nerd is here again. Bringing you news and knowledge from the world of computers and technology, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
The website for our radio show here is ComputerTalkRadio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com is a place you can go to check out the podcast. You can check out the news articles. You can also reach out to me. Scroll down to where it says contact us today. There's an entire page for filling out your questions. Of course, you can also phone me at 888-NERD. 888. That's 888-6373-888. Either way you reach out to me, of course, I am interested in your computer questions and your technology concerns, and I will get back to you with those answers. Steve Keske joins me now, and Steve, you had told me just before we hit record, you wanted to talk about the history of money.
Money.
And how it interrelates to technology.
That's
so
it.
So let's go. Yes.
Well, let's start out with saying, if you really want to start, go way back.
Yeah.
We're starting out with the old barter system.
Sure. A matter of, hey, I'm going to work for you for 4 hours doing woodwork, and you're going to work for me for 4 hours doing brickwork. And
It goes back a bit further.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, I've got 2 sheep to sell.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have the money for your sheep, okay? What can you give me that you think is worth the same as 2 sheep?
3 goats?
3 goats?
Sure.
You know, that's...
I couldn't figure out where to go with that, so yeah, so 3 goats.
But that's,
they're smaller, so you know, I
gotta add one to it. But yes, that's the way the barter system worked.
Sure, yeah.
And then, of course, you got people that decided that they wanted to dominate other people.
Mm-hmm.
So then they started using coinage.
Yes. And the coinage actually really just replaced some level of that barter system, because we still had barter for quite a while under the concept of money. A matter of how much silver coinage will you give me for my 50 sheep?
Yeah.
Or for my 50 loads of hay, or whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever.
And you would go back and forth, and you would argue out the idea of how much that silver could buy of the sheep or hay or whatever. And it applied to a number of other metals, too.
Yes.
But, of course, along the way, we know that counterfeiting came along. So we actually moved from just raw silver and gold into coinage.
And then from coinage, because people were going out there and counterfeiting.
Yeah.
We went to paper.
Yes.
But paper wasn't all that safe either.
No. So, yes, you're very right.
And that got counterfeited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
and then they added in anti-counterfeiting things over the years.
Oh, yeah. And then the smarter that the government got in trying to keep their money, paper money, from being counterfeited,
yeah,
the counterfeiters figured out ways to bypass it.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And it went from there. And then somebody, way back when, said, well, why don't we do this all on credit?
Yes.
So they developed a credit card.
Yes, back in the 60s. Actually, I think before then, there were credit cards, but it was individualized credit cards. You went to the local department store and they had their own credit card and stuff like that. But the idea of a universal credit card came a bit later, around the 60s, I seem to recall.
Yeah.
And,
anyway.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, well, you know, that's not all that safe either, because if I steal your credit card, whoa, wait a minute here. So then they decided to put a magnetic strip on it.
Yes, yes.
Well, that was okay up to a point, but people were stealing the information and redoing those strips.
Yes, indeed.
And so somebody said, well, let's put all the information on a chip and put it on the card.
Yeah. Well, the information actually doesn't reside on the strip or the card, the chip. It actually is information that can exchange to the bank in the form of the mag stripe. It was the credit card number and some cross identification encryption so that the information could be exchanged with the bank and they could validate that that was you were reasonably sure that the credit card was good. Now, with the chip, it's far more accurate because it's a rotating number each time the chip is used, and the bank actually goes through an authentication process that's pretty much cooler than the mag stripe ever was.
Yeah, but even that wasn't perfect.
No. Yeah, we continue to have problems with those.
Yeah, we still do. And then they decided, well, wait a minute. Why not do this all over the internet and you can use your smartphone?
Yes. Yeah. Well, to some extent, I have credit cards, a couple of them, loaded onto my smartphone. And I can utilize those that way. There is one credit card, which is a virtual card, which is also loaded onto my smartphone. And I can utilize those cards wherever I go. The authentication is not much better. The real advantage to that is I don't give anybody the credit card.
No.
It doesn't actually hit their hands. It stays in my phone. And once I leave my phone alone for a couple of minutes, it's not likely anybody's getting into it, at least not for the credit cards.
No.
So I want you to put your thinking hat on. I want you to think to the future.
Ooh.
What do you think we're going to see? I mean, we've seen a progression here for a while. It is not as fast as the microchip progresses or anything like that.
Yeah.
But what do you think we might see in the future that might be the replacement for, well, the progression, the next step in progression for money, for exchange of value for goods?
That's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
But my first, shall we say, my first inclination is to say we go to a total credit system.
Mm, okay.
So we don't get paid in coins or dollars or yen or whatever. We get paid in credits.
Okay.
Therefore, the credits can be used anywhere.
Yeah. My only problem with that is one of the problems that I've had with credit itself. And I've always thought about this, and that is the idea that as we move along, every time we make a transaction, somebody out there takes a small piece of that transaction. And then if I pay you $100, somebody takes 3% away. They give you 97. Now, when you give somebody else 97, that 3% is taken away out of that 97. And it keeps moving around and moving around. And then eventually, none of that money exists at all.
Yep.
And it's kind of a struggle I have.
I know. I struggle with the whole idea of credit because of the fact that like a lot of people, I like to see it in my hand.
Indeed. Yeah. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me now. And Doreen, you've got a new conference whisper that you put out recently that you wanted to bring up, something about construction?
Yeah, it's actually a whisper report. What job site tech boosts output most today? But it was researched at Con Expo, which we had covered the conference whisper before.
Sure, yeah.
It's one of the whisper report questions, 2151.
Okay.
The number.
All right.
So that means, yeah, the URL /TBW2151 is where you can find it.
Okay. All right. And that's at TBWAdvisors.com.
Correct. Technical Business Whispers, TBW. Because sometimes it's hard to delineate those letters.
Sure, yeah.
And this one we had someone from Weir Esco Division, Mobile Automation, Doosan Bobcat, and John Deere.
Okay, nice. So,
yeah. Oh, definitely brought it home. And we got four completely different answers, so it was fun. So the first answer was from Weir Esco, right? And they're the ones, they make buckets.
Okay. Right. Like so buckets for like the tractors.
An excavator.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right.
Not
yeah.
The
okay.
Type you take to the beach with your family.
Sure. Sure.
This is that big monstrous thing that when you stand next to it, like you could stand in the opening of these things.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
These are monstrous. Your entire car could fit into these buckets. And that's what he was talking about. I mean, if I have a bigger bucket, I can improve your productivity, your output.
Okay, yeah.
Because I do one grab of whatever it is we're digging up and excavating,
sure.
And I do the same work as someone with a smaller bucket.
Sure.
But then he also talked about they have a technology that they were very proud and excited about, that their teeth are very sturdy.
Okay.
If the bucket goes into the big hole and it breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
You've kind of defeated the purpose of having a big bucket because you have to find the broken piece and get it unstuck and get it out, and then you have all that downtime.
Yeah.
So
okay.
They said, we got big buckets and they don't break. Mobile automation says, no. I got one machine, but it does the job of three.
Okay.
Right? So if you're going to do a pool in your backyard,
yeah,
this bucket excavates, does, I apologize, I'm not very knowledgeable on all the different types of equipment, but it does the job of three different pieces of equipment in one small piece of equipment, and it's all automated, so you don't have to be that knowledgeable of how to operate all these different things. It does it.
So the construction worker just drives it in, presses a button, and it just digs the big, huge pool? And
yeah, and, okay. And the one machine does it, and it's fairly easy for the one do, even though it may technically do the job of three different machines.
Okay.
And because you didn't have to get one machine back there, then get it out, and the backyards always tend to be tight, especially if the neighborhood's already built,
sure.
And then get another machine in the backyard and get it out and all of that, none of that has to occur. They have one tiny machine that can fit in like a 2-3 foot wide opening, goes back there and operates like three machines.
Nice.
And automation, and they're like, we're going to keep your uptime. We'll get it done real quick.
Well, and from a logistics standpoint, you think about it. If it's one machine doing it, people don't really think about the idea of, okay, if you have to deliver three different tractors in, there is a cost expenditure for putting that tractor onto the onto the trailer and then delivering that tractor. Okay, and then we've got to swap that out. So we've got to bring out the new tractor, put the old tractor onto the trailer, bring the the truck back, and then you do the whole same thing over again.
Right.
So
and
there's
the environmental impact of
sure.
the transportation of
sure.
the materials required to make
sure.
five machines instead of one.
Sure. And the speed involved
to run the
too.
Business.
Yes.
Money to run the business for the person needing to buy or rent five pieces of equipment.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's
good stuff. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So Doosan Bobcat says, we are highlighting our collision avoidance system, and this increases your uptime, similar to why the Weir ESCO team says.
Okay.
Because anytime you think you're going to run into something, you have to pause. If you do crash into something and it's a human being, well, you got the ambulance.
Oops.
And all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's another expenditure.
Damage, the physical damage. Yeah. Time delay.
Not that we're concerned about the money in this case, but yes.
Right. Yeah. If you run into an object, you probably broke it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The time and cost delay, right? And so when you're operating these big machines, because grace and efficiency and movement from A to B and getting the job done without
sure.
crashing
yeah.
increases your output. And Doosan Bobcat was very excited about their solution that they feel was top end. And so that was the angle they came at it.
Okay.
They said, we're going to keep you going without messing up between A and B and everything in between. Then John Deere says, we have connected support, connected platform, and connected everything. So, even if your machine broke in the hole, we'd know about it, and we'd have your, help path on the way before you even picked up the phone to call us, right?
Wow, yeah.
We know what your machine is doing, and we know what season it is. Maybe you got agriculture instead of construction, or
sure,
you know
yeah.
where you are in the job site. And we'll say, based on your project plan, you probably want to replace that part first. So it's going to go right in the middle of when you're laying those floors. Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be more cost effective, even with the use of life lefts, to do it now in the downtime before you start getting into the job.
Okay.
So you save the labor time on the job, the people waiting for the and all of that. So they really stepped back and said, we're strategically in the big picture, looking across multiple silos of the business as it's generally looked, and trying to help it all be efficient.
That is some cool stuff. I had heard that John Deere had arrived at that kind of point where they could not only see, but to do a lot of remote control operations for repair. Something along the lines of, you call that the support desk, and they remote control your system, and they go, oh, hey, here's your problem here. Let's just reinstall this software, or whatever it is that they're doing. John Deere can do the same, which is really moving ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And that Doosan Bobcat featured that electrification engine that we spoke about during Conference Whispers at Con Expo,
okay.
Where it had the different modules, and you just re-put the module in, and Moog engines could just flash it and go, I know this business, this farm, that construction company, this location, this module acts this way. So you just go snap in the new part for the electric engine, and they remotely flash it like it's supposed to act for your location and your whole electric motor, so to speak. Just like we saw something with surge protections at the ISC West, right plug and play, not just predictive analytics and maintenance, but remote and predictive and over the air updates, which of course assumes you have secure connectivity and all of that, so you have to have the right network infrastructure between the equipment, and which we covered a lot of that at MWC, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is showing a lot of how technology is evolving. And it's no longer just the diesel engine out there just going chug, 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 chug. This is really a whole new level, and technology is going to bring us in a distinct new direction over the coming years.
And they need to because of the users as well.
Definitely.
The drivers.
Definitely. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And Dr. Doreen Galley.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping MicroCenter for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, MicroCenter has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, MicroCenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's MicroCenter, built for what's next. MicroCenter.com. The website ComputerTalkRadio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to me, ask me your questions, just scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to those questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Now, every so often, something surfaces in the tech world that really makes you stop and ask if we've quietly crossed a line without noticing. There is a new revelation about Windows assigning every installation a permanent global device identifier, or GDID. And this is one of those moments. This is a reminder to us that privacy is not always lost in dramatic leaps, but frequently in small, quiet steps. This global device identifier, it's not a marketing feature. It's not a convenience tool. It is a fingerprint that Windows assigns to your computer. It can't be turned off. You never agreed to it, and you were never asked. It simply exists, baked into the operating system itself. Microsoft only acknowledged this identifier after a court case forced the issues. It came out because the FBI used it to identify a hacker who tried to hide behind VPNs and proxies and rotating IP addresses. Even with all that camouflage, that identifier tied everything back to this guy's device. Now, catching a criminal is one thing, but the fact that this identifier fingerprints every single ordinary PC is another one. It means that we all have permanent tags on each of our devices that follow us across the internet, across everything we do, our daily lives, and it can't be disabled. This is not the first time that Microsoft has pushed the boundaries of what it collects. We have seen things like various telemetry items, advertising IDs, activity histories, and that feature recall, which we've covered a number of times here on the show, which captures screenshots of everything on your screen. And most of these are opt out rather than opt in. You have to go find wherever it is and say, no, I don't want that turned on. However, with this one, independent tests have shown that a fresh Windows install contacts Microsoft and third-party servers before you even open a browser. This is documented, and it's not a conspiracy theory. This is fact. The privacy concern isn't that this global device identifier exists. The privacy concern I'm going to share with you is that this all exists without any kind of transparency, consent. We didn't even know about it. There's no off switch. It's just a permanent identifier tied to your computer, and it survives everything you do to it. It only disappears if you wipe the machine and reinstall Windows. And even then, you might accumulate another ID in the second you log in with your Microsoft account. It goes, oh, this looks like the same computer. It's just been reformatted. It just becomes a number of different things that they tie back to you. Now, this raises concerns. If Microsoft can track a device across all of these different things I've laid out, including international borders, what else can it track? What else is being logged? What else is being folded, spindled, mutilated, correlated, all of that processed behind the scenes? This rabbit hole can get far deeper than you might ever think about. It is insane. We've reached a point where privacy is not about what you choose to share. It is more about what your devices share on your behalf by the direction of somebody that's not in your home. This is really getting scary. We already know about Google and Facebook and all of those different intrusions into how they spy on us for their own gain. And Microsoft is spying on us for some unknown gain that we don't even know about. This is not a standalone issue. This is all kinds of different cloud-linked features and background services and identifiers and telemetry streams. Where are you going? Each of these different things adds multiple layers onto the pictures that other people are building about your digital life. Yes, again, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, whoever it is, it doesn't matter. And the more that these layers start to accumulate, the harder it's going to become for us to maintain any meaningful anonymity. You can use a VPN. You can change your IP address. You can block cookies. But if your own operating system has a permanent fingerprint, everything you do is just window dressing. This is where personal privacy becomes more than a technical topic. It becomes a question of trust. How much should Facebook know about you? How much should Google know about you and collect? How much should it process? And how much should Microsoft be allowed to hand over when simply asked? Okay, maybe there was some level of warrants or whatever. I'm not even sure on this, but all of this starts going down scary roads. Microsoft, they've said that this global device identifier helps with licensing and with service management. That's fancy words for helping your computer run better. But all that may be true, but the fact that it can be used to essentially hunt down, yes, a bad guy, in this case, that's how we found out about it, but used to track every device across the internet is a capability that really deserves debate and scrutiny and transparency. Once all of these capabilities exist, we know from past experience that they rarely stay confined to their original purpose. Data collected for convenience often becomes utilitarian in nature that can be used for surveillance, enforcement, or in the case of Meta and Alphabet, the other names for Facebook and Google, for monetization. And that's why this matters. Not because Microsoft is the computer talk radio villain of the week, but because this is part of a larger pattern across the entire tech industry. Companies are asking for more data. They are looking for more details about us, any insight that they can get into our behavior. And sometimes they're pulling this information with just the idea of storing it until they figure out what they're going to do with it. The problem is we rarely understand or know what we're giving up. There are settings, toggles, and we assume that they control everything. But in this case, this identifier has no toggle, no off switch. It's simply there, shaping the boundaries of privacy. I really regret that we've come this far. And I don't want us to accept a future where our devices fingerprint us without consent. We shouldn't have a future where privacy depends on hidden identifiers buried in system files. And we should not accept a future where anonymity becomes impossible because the operating system itself refuses to let go. Once we lose control over our digital identity, we lose control over our digital freedom. And once freedom is gone, it's nigh impossible to get it back. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how sometimes we have parallels in the professional world that you can apply in your own world. And one of the things that I go back in my mind on for this topic is I worked for a company a number of years ago, and the owner had bought this DOS-based ERP software back in about 93 or so. And when he bought it then, he really loved it. And he continued to love it all the way through. But as it grew older, we needed to give it more maintenance. And it would crash out at the strangest times. I will tell you that I put in place an automation that would go through and index the files and go through a lot of different optimizations to make sure it kept running. And I ran that about once a week. And that worked most of the time. But every once in a while, somebody would reach out to me and say, it's crashed again. Okay, great. It's going to take an hour for us to bring this important. This is the key software in the company. It's going to take me an hour to bring it back up. And I suggested many times for him to replace it, for him to look for another alternative. Why? I've spent good money on this. Yeah, this is like 15 years ago or more, actually. And he just held to that. He just kept on going, oh, this is great. This is fine. Most people assume that their devices can handle far more than they actually can. It's not arrogance, it's optimism. Modern tech feels powerful, so everyone expects it to perform flawlessly, no matter what they throw at it. This happens because the initial experience, that early time with it, whether it's software or a new device or whatever, it's smooth. Everything, the apps will open instantly, storage feels endless, performance feels effortless, and that early impression becomes this baseline expectation. We can think of this like your phone, and it starts slowing down after a year or two of photos, apps, and updates, and you start to wonder what went wrong, forgetting how much you've put into this, how much you've been driving this forward. And we see this across all kinds of technology. People will overload their Wi-Fi networks with the streaming, the gaming, the video calls, and smart devices, and your network just chokes. It struggles. But there's this expectation we all have that it should just work. And in workplaces, this becomes far more visible. Teams expect laptops to handle dozens of tabs, multiple apps, and heavy multitasking without slowing down. The device wasn't designed for that level of constant load. Just like over the course of the 15 years, that company went from a very small mom-and-pop kind of feel to a point where it was ready to be bought out because it was putting out multiple widgets and far more than it had ever really done. And the software was meant for a small company, about 20 to 30 users, not 150 users. And we see this everywhere. We see this across all kinds of different things. People will hold on to their tools because they fear going to the next tool. Oh, it's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be a lot more money. It's going to be whatever, whatever, whatever. And they put all kinds of objections up. They say, this isn't a direction we need to go in. We just need to stick with what we knew worked 10 years ago. Well, it worked 10 years ago, but the advances that have come along in those 10 years have dramatically shifted everything. They've changed all of this. And then, of course, when the tech hits its limit, the surprise feels personal. Everybody thinks something broke, when in reality, the system simply reached the edge of its capacity. IT pros work by setting realistic expectations, and we talk about things like capacity and load and performance, and we bring these to you in plain English, so you understand what the tools can truly handle. And we can apply real-world comparisons. A car can drive fast, but not if you've got a big, huge trailer attached to it. A kitchen can cook a meal for a home kitchen for, you know, a few people. You're not going to be able to do it for 100 guests. Technology follows these same kinds of rules. So we really need to be thinking about healthy digital habits across everything. And that includes, yes, closing unused apps and managing storage and reducing background tasks on our desktops and laptops. And those help keep systems running smoothly without major changes. But we also need to be thinking about the digital habits of replacing outdated software and outdated hardware servers that are sitting around that are, you know, 5, 7, 10 years old. Those are going to slow down the entire company. When upgrades are needed, we need to be framing this entire idea as improvements to comfort and reliability, and we need to help people see the value instead of the cost. Tech works best when expectations match reality. And when we all understand the limits of our devices, we can use them more intentionally. That awareness reduces frustration, it improves performance, and it helps everyone get more out of the tools they rely on every day. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
You
years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Alicia's question. Rewording it a little bit here. I'm seeing more websites ask me to create an account just to read an article. Is that about security or just tracking? Oh, boy. Yeah, websites ask for accounts because they state they want a stable identity to tie your visits together. Although, all of this is less about protecting you and more about understanding who's reading what. And that identity helps them personalize content as well as advertising. Now, a lot of sites are they're shifting towards this. They want to start sending you emails. They want you to sign up and all of that as well. Many sites used to rely on third-party tracking like cookies to really understand the visitors, but a lot of browsers are phasing this out. Without that login tool, websites want accounts as the new way to keep their analytics running. And this is a shift in the industry. It's not some kind of security need on their part. Some sites, yeah, they do use accounts to save your preferences or to keep track of paid subscriptions, but most of the time, the requirement appears even when the content is free. This is a sign that motivation is data. Yeah, your data, not protection. And frustration pops up. It comes from the mismatch between what you want, a quick read, and what the site wants, a long-term committed relationship. This account wall is their way of nudging you into that relationship. So it's not about safety. It's about replacing all of the old tracking methods with something that is going to be far more durable. Now, you can sometimes bypass these walls by using a browser's reader mode or opening the link in a private window or utilizing a number of different resources which go through and just strip away the tracking layers and show you the text without forcing an account. A simple workaround. It keeps your privacy, your email, and all of the other information intact. If you do create accounts, use a password manager and a throwaway email. This will help you avoid clutter. It'll keep your main inbox clean. It also limits how much of your identity the site can connect to your reading habits. When we start looking at the workplace, we're also seeing a lot of tension there. All of these different places want analytics to understand their audience, but they also claim they want to respect privacy. So there's a balance here, and it's tricky. And the account wall is a blunt tool that companies use to bridge that gap. They want to understand. There's a lot of people who are logging in from XYZ Incorporated. Let's see if we can get one of the salesmen on the line to the proper purchaser and whatever else. Across society, though, people are pushing back on these different walls because they interrupt the natural flow of reading. Yeah, there are companies that are experimenting with software approaches, but the industry hasn't settled on a better solution yet. So we're going to be facing this for quite a while. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at StrokesNoJoke.org. That's StrokesNoJoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.